When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to another episode of This Week in History. We have got a cracker for you. One of the greatest British victories of all time. One of the best battles in history. One that's been requested by so many people. One that I have been saving. It's one I wanted to do right from the start of doing this podcast. It's one I thought I would save until, one, I knew more about it. Two, there was, I would say a lull in the podcast because I knew that it's one that will regenerate people. People will come back to listen to this one. And I knew there would come a point where I wouldn't be able to get podcasts out. And this would be one that people would go, oh my God, he's finally done it. And I was talking to Dad about it, and I thought, we can do this. This is a great subject. And Dad basically said, I'll do that one, because he knows quite a bit about it as well. So, I do know bits about this. I have bored the children to death with this story. You came with us to the Royal Armouries Museum in Leeds, and they've got a depiction of the battle, and I went there probably about a year before that, took the kids, and I told them everything about the Battle of Waterloo, and they have never looked so bored in their entire life. So when I took you there, it's fantastic. What you can see, they've basically, I don't know if anyone listening has ever been to the Royal Armouries Museum in Leeds. You can see they've basically done a depiction of the battle with miniature figures, and they're all painted. And what's most important about this, and I would say the same as Trafalgar, we beat the shit out of the French. And that's the most important thing to remember about this battle and about these ones. So
that's a running theme, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Agincourt, Trafalgar.
Yeah, Battle of Waterloo. So one of the, like I said, the most famous battle in British history. Or at least up there. Not non-naval battle, because I think Trafalgar does beat it on the basis that Nelson is more famous than Arthur Wellesley. I think, there's statues of Nelson. I don't even know if there's a statue of the Duke of Wellington.
They're bound to be somewhere.
Yeah. So, obviously, Nelson is a lot more popular, and Britain is known for the Navy. So, but I would say this is probably one of the greatest British battles of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't all the British, but we still won, so it doesn't matter. Take it away.
Well, we nearly lost it.
Yeah, we did. But we didn't lose it, and that's the most important thing.
Yeah. Right. So, whilst discussing some of the most important events in history, both Dan and I agreed this subject podcast definitely falls into that bracket.
Yeah.
It may not be important or relevant to the world outside of Europe, but on this continent, it was one of the biggest and bloodiest battles up to that point in history, and one of the most pivotal battles ever to take place.
Mm.
As with a lot of conflicts throughout recorded history, it involved a very small island off of the northwest coast of the continent, and it's, in this case, a country immediately to its east. Of course, we're talking about Britain and France.
Yeah.
But in reality, it wasn't just Britain and France. Britain takes the credit for this battle. But it did involve
a large
number of nations. And it basically ended the Napoleonic Wars.
Yeah, and the we'd already ended Napoleon and he came back. We'd already beaten him and he got moved to Sardinia, sent home, put on an island, told to rot there, and then he decided to come back and take over France as the Emperor of France.
All part of the story.
So, yeah. Take it away.
So we're talking about the Battle of Waterloo. Although, to be honest, Field Marshal Boucher wanted to call it the Battle of La Belle Alliance. La Belle Alliance.
No, it's Waterloo.
And the French, well, they call it the Battle of Mont-Saint-Jean.
Mm. Or the Battle of Disgrace.
Well, they don't teach it very much.
No, either. I'm not surprised.
Britain and France had been at war on and off since 1689.
Yeah.
But for the 23 years prior to 1815, it was the whole of Europe that had been at war with France.
Yeah.
With France and Britain being on opposing sides. And during the majority of that time, the leader of the French army was a gentleman called Napoleon Bonaparte. Initially, he was only a corporal, but he rose to be a military leader and later became Napoleon I, Emperor of France. History will show him as one of the greatest military leaders of all time.
Yeah.
Under his guidance, France conquered vast areas of Europe, and it was purely down to this man that France created its empire. But even the best make mistakes, and Napoleon's biggest came a few years before, in 1812, when he led his Grande Armée into Russia for an invasion of Russia. He took with him 685,000 men into Russia in 1812. History shows that only 31,000 marched out again in any form of military formation. Now, eventually, another 35,000 stragglers would make it back to France. That made a total of less than 70,000 known survivors. Less than 11% of the army that went into Russia.
Yeah.
He was beaten by disease, lack of supplies, length of supply lines, and of course, the Russian winter.
Yeah.
The same factors that would beat Germany over a century later in 1941.
Yeah, and just for the Americans, just to add that, that's what lost Germany the war. Not the Americans joining, Germany's...
Germany's
decision to invade Russia is what cost them the war. Well, the Americans helped, but it's a little bugbear because I get it so much online. Americans going, "Well, we helped you win the war." I'm like, "No, you didn't help us win the war. Germany helped us win the war by losing it to Russia. They made the wrong decision.
If they hadn't gone into Russia, we would be all Turk and German." Would agree with that.
Because I don't think even America would have... Because at the start of the Second World War, I think America had like the 40th biggest army in the world, something like that. They wouldn't have... Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, I'm digressing. Let's get back to the real story.
Yeah. I mean, the Napoleonic invasion of Russia served as a major turning point in European history because the defeat led to the fall of Napoleon and his French Empire in the 19th century.
Yes.
He was forced to abdicate the leadership of the country. And with that vacuum left by his leading, he's actually leaving. The other nations of Europe met at a Congress of Vienna, 1814 to 1815. basically to establish a new governmental structure, order, and the way things were going to plan out for Europe. And like you said, Napoleon was exiled to a small island 10 miles off the coast of Italy. And this Congress of Vienna restored the French monarchy with Louis XVIII.
Yeah. Which is mental, because a few years later they beheaded. Was it Louis XVI?
Well, they'd already had the French Revolution.
Yeah, that was Louis XVI or 15th?
14th?
One of them. Louis the something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a problem with this solution. Napoleon was actually still very popular with the majority of ordinary Frenchmen.
Yeah.
And the king wasn't. Louis XVIII didn't have the charm or the charisma of the emperor. And with the French economy failing, it didn't take long for the public and the general population to start blaming the king for their problems.
Mm-hmm.
Added to the fact that the now royalist government was threatening to abolish some of the gains obtained by the French Revolution, and they refused to pay Napoleon the pension he was promised. They promised, you know, Napoleon, go and live in this island. This is your little empire. Here's a pension for it. And they refused to pay it.
Wasn't he from Sardinia as well? I'm sure he was Italian.
I think he was. I didn't go that far into it.
Oh.
The king soon became very, very unpopular.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, on Elba, Napoleon was actually kept up to date with the situation because he had newspapers, he had a network of informants, and he actually began to believe that the French people really preferred him to lead the country instead of the king. And he wasn't wrong.
No, he wasn't.
On the 26th of February, 1815, Napoleon left Elba with 650 guards. He also had 100 Polish lancers and Corsicans and a couple of native Elban volunteers, and he headed off to South France.
The smallest invasion force ever.
They landed near Antibes on the 1st of March and took control of the city of Cannes. It's where the film festival is, isn't it?
Yeah.
The city of Cannes. He'd only been in exile for less than 10 months. May 1814 to March 1815. But he began his march towards Paris, and he collected supporters en route. Funnily enough, including some of the military units that were sent to stop him.
Brilliant.
He even had the front to send a message to the king, which said, from Napoleon to Louis XVIII, my dear brother, it is not necessary to send me more troops. I already have enough. the king, being unable to attain any military or popular support, buggered off to Belgium. He just escaped to Belgium.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
And Napoleon entered the city of Paris without firing a single shot. Napoleon was greeted with enthusiasm and excitement, not only because he was perceived as a national hero, but because, along on his way to Paris, he had promised constitutional reform and direct elections to an assembly.
So, like, normal democracy, basically. Yeah.
The Congress of Vienna, which had previously exiled Napoleon, reconvened, realising that he was now back as emperor, and this creates major instability on the continent. He's got to be stopped.
Yeah.
War was coming. Napoleon had to be stopped. The Seventh Coalition was officially established, consisting of Britain, Austria, Prussia, and Russia, along with a few smaller countries. The coalition signed a formal defence treaty with other European nations and declared war on Napoleon himself.
Oh, okay.
Not on France.
I didn't know that. I just assumed it was France.
The coalition still had a number of armies on the continent, namely the British one, the Prussian, the Russian, the Austrian, and the Dutch. So there were five armies still in the continent, still on the continent, and available.
Yeah.
Now, Napoleon knew that in order to survive, he needed to defeat this alliance. He knew that his army, large but still wasn't sufficient in number to defeat the five that are against him. His only option was to defeat them one by one before they had a chance to combine and end up as 5-1.
Yeah.
So he chose to move the main part of his army secretly towards the north and the Belgian border, where there were two Allied armies. The Anglo-Dutch army, commanded by the Duke of Wellington, and the Prussian army, commanded by Field Marshal Blücher. They were both stationed near to the Belgian border, but they were 10 miles apart.
Right, okay.
So for the purpose of this podcast, I'll refer to Napoleon's forces as the French and Wellington's forces as the British Allied or Anglo-Dutch army.
Yeah.
Yeah. Napoleon's plan was to defeat the Prussians before taking on the Anglo-Dutch. To do this, he had to engage the Prussians as soon as possible. He knew that the two armies were not very far apart, and his intention was to drive his own forces between them, place a small force to hold the Anglo-Dutch at a place called the Quatre Bases, while he took on the Prussians.
Yeah.
Now, he managed to get his army into position without being detected before he made his move. So in the early hours of the 16th of June, Napoleon attacked. His main assault was against the Prussian army at Ligny, where he attacked with 63,000 men, 210 cannons. Now, knowing that Wellington wasn't far away and could be called on to arrive during the battle if he needed, he had to prevent this. So he sent additional troops under Field Marshal Ney to attack the Anglo-Dutch army at Quatre Bases. This had the effect that Napoleon wanted. Now, this minor battle at Quatre Bases wasn't a victory for either side, but Wellington didn't retreat.
Yeah. But it served the purpose because it meant that he couldn't go and reinforce the Prussians.
Yeah. So during the day, Napoleon, believing he was winning, sent an order for a section of Ney's troops to make its way towards the Prussians.
Yeah.
So he could complete their total defeat. This group amounted to 20 to 30,000 men. And it was under the command of Marshal Jean-Baptiste de Comte de Herlo. Which I'm not going to repeat.
You sure?
You're positive. And they began to arrive at Ligny in the late afternoon. So they were arriving to join the battle.
Yeah.
They were spotted by Napoleon while still several miles away, but they were initially mistaken for Prussian reinforcements.
Right, makes sense.
Napoleon adjusted his plans accordingly by pausing his attacks. Before these additional forces could join the fight, they received an order from Marshal Ney to make their way back to his engagement at Quatre Bases.
Mm-hmm.
As a result, de Herlo's forces spent the whole day marching from one battle to the other, but actually fighting in neither.
Right, okay.
Neither Napoleon or Ney was aware of the other one's orders. And it's highly likely if they'd have joined either Ney or Napoleon, the Battle of Waterloo would never have occurred and Napoleon would have won the campaign.
Yeah.
It was probably the biggest mistake he actually made.
Without realising he'd made it as well.
Without realising he made it. So after the French withdrew from Quatre Bases, Wellington very quickly realised the attack wasn't the full French army. And its purpose was to prevent him from going to the assistance of Blücher. He knew that the main French force, having engaged Blücher, would soon turn its attentions to him, and he needed a better place to take on Napoleon. Quatre Bases was not that place. As a result, he started to move his army north, looking for a more favourable ground. Meanwhile, 10 miles to the east, the Battle of Ligny had resulted in a tactical victory for the French. But the bulk of the 84,000-man Prussian army had survived, and they still had their equipment, so they had good battle order.
Yeah.
This was purely down to the fact that Napoleon had paused his forces during the attack, as the previously mentioned.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Unfortunately for Napoleon, the Prussians didn't retreat to the east along their communication route, but they went north, which put them parallel to Wellington's march, and still within supporting distance. To make matters worse for Napoleon, the two armies remained in communication with each other, which is a fact he wasn't aware of. So the two Allied armies were both now heading in the same direction, 10 miles apart. Napoleon, believing he'd beaten the Prussians, now turned his attention to the Anglo-Dutch army, and he headed to join Marshal Ney, who he believed was still engaging and harassing Wellington's forces. Small part of his main force, under the command of Marshal Grouchet, was dispatched to harass the retreating Prussians, while he turned his army through the rain to meet up with Ney. When he arrived on the 17th of June, he was disappointed to find that Wellington had retreated north and Ney wasn't chasing him as instructed. After Quatre Bras, the Duke of Wellington knew that Napoleon was coming, and knowing what was left of the Prussian army, still around 45,000 men, was available to assist at short notice, he decided he was going to make a stand. He'd never faced Napoleon directly, but he was fully aware of what he was heading into. Napoleon was a formidable leader, and the French army under him had proved to be capable of beating any opponent that they came across on their day. The two sides fought their battles very differently. Wellington used the typical British system, later known as the Thin Red Line because of the red coats.
Yeah.
This took the form of a long, unbroken line of soldiers standing shoulder to shoulder, two or three deep, depending on how large the front was. And this allowed the ranks to keep up a constant stream of musket fire. The French, on the other hand, used the tactic of massed infantry, advancing straight at the enemy, fierce and intimidating, with a view to overwhelming a portion of the opposition and breaking through their lines.
Yeah.
Now, with this knowledge, Wellington decided the battle would take place at Mont-Saint-Jean. And there's a place called by that little village called the Mont-Saint-Jean Escarpment.
Yeah.
Okay, for the English spelling, it's Mount St. Jean.
Yeah? Yeah.
That's how it's written, but it's Mont Saint-Jean. Yeah. This escarpment crossed the Brussels Road, 3 miles south of a small village called Waterloo. Having decided on the location, he sent word to Field Marshal Blücher asking for assistance. He'd chosen the location well, because on the 17th of June, the same day as Napoleon joined up with Ney, Wellington, under heavy rain, placed his troops on the backside of a ridge.
Yeah.
This would give them some protection from the French cannon fire and would put them out of sight of advancing troops until the last moments. On the right flank, about 500 yards ahead of the main battle line, was the walled farmhouse of Hougoumont. At the centre of Wellington's line, about 1,100 yards across from Hougoumont, was another farmhouse, La Haye Sainte. And also another 500 yards in front of the line. So you've got the two.
Yeah.
Off to the left and taking up the left flank were two more farmhouses, La Haye and Papelotte. So let's paint a picture. The Allied forces, imagine a large letter E, a capital E, turned 90 degrees with the three prongs facing downwards.
Yep.
The main force in a straight line with the farmhouses at the end of the three extended lines. Hougoumont at the bottom line, La Haye Sainte, the centre, and the other two on the top line.
Okay, yeah, that makes
sense. Then imagine the E from below looking onto the three farms. You can see the three farms, but not the troops behind them due to the hill. This is what would face the French when they arrived. Wellington knew it was a good defensive position, and to make it harder for the attacking forces, he put a garrison of elite forces inside each of the three farmhouses. They fortified their position and waited for the morning of the 18th of June. The whole width of Wellington's army was only 2.5 miles, which is unusually short for a line of battle at the time. And he knew that any attempt by Napoleon to attack the flank of Wellington's forces would require substantial numbers to overcome the fortified farmhouses. And to attack his centre would mean entering a box of fire from the front and from the two farmhouses.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's not really an easy way for them to get in.
No. The two armies were fairly even in numbers. Napoleon had 71,947 men, all of whom were veterans. In addition, he had 246 cannons. He also had the Imperial Guard, known as the Old Guard or the Immortals, and they were probably the best trained military unit in the world at the time.
Yeah, they were.
They had the best equipment along with the best training. They were the largest and tallest of all the French army. And to make them all even more intimidating, they wore tall fur-covered hats, making them appear even taller. Another advantage that Napoleon had was the fact that his whole army spoke the same language.
Yes.
Wellington, on the other hand, had 67,601 men, 4,000 less, and only 156 cannons, which was 90 less. His troops were a mixture of nationalities and languages, with only 31,000, a third of them, being British. And most of these hadn't seen battle before. They were new.
Yeah.
Although Wellington had made expert use of the terrain, he knew that his 67,151 guns would barely hold their own until evening against Napoleon's 72,000-ish,
yeah,
and 246 guns. Wellington wasn't expecting to beat the French. He needed the Prussians to arrive and save the day.
Yeah.
He literally needed them because the French were going to beat him.
Yeah, they were
better.
He
knew that even with all the advantages that
he'd put in place.
So Napoleon drew up his forces on the southern ridge, centred at a place called La Belle Alliance, 1,200 yards south of Wellington's position. It had been raining all night, the ground was soaked, but dawn on that Sunday morning was bright and the overnight rain had stopped. It was all now set for one of the greatest battles in European history. Due to the heavy rain the previous day and night, Wellington did decide to delay his attack on Wellington's forces until the ground had dried a little. To be honest, it ain't going to dry much.
No.
But this is what he did.
Napoleon wasn't stupid, though, was he?
Definitely not. You know. So he decided to delay his attack on Wellington's forces until the ground had dried. In his initial condition, he felt that his cannons, infantry and cavalry would actually struggle climbing the gentle hill towards any engagement. But he didn't believe that the opposition was any good, and his opinion was not only the troops were bad, but they were badly led.
Yeah, he had no faith in Wellington, did he?
In fact, during his breakfast, he was heard to say, "This affair is nothing more than eating breakfast." Unfortunately for him, he remained ignorant of the exact position of Wellington's main force, which was situated over the rise, because he could only see a small number of artillery units and a few skirmishers. Now, his belief was that Wellington had positioned himself further back from the ridge and closer to the village of Saint-Mongin.
Mm-hmm.
He did, however, have a clear view of the three fortified farmhouses and could see some forces on the top of the hill, but he didn't know how many were hidden by the rise. Against advice from his generals, he waited until 11 o'clock in the morning to begin his attack. Now, the exact time of the battle is actually in dispute. Napoleon records it as 11 o'clock, whereas Wellington recorded it as 10 o'clock. Either way.
Do you think that's because the British are an hour ahead of the French? Or an hour behind?
The British are always ahead of the French.
No, but like the GMT.
Could be, yeah.
Which would make sense that Wellington's using British time and Napoleon's using French time. So that would be the same time.
Could be. Either way, Napoleon began the battle by sending a small number of troops to attack the farmhouse on his left at Hougoumont. His hope was to draw out the opposing forces from the centre to assist with the defence of the farmhouse. This was not intended to be a big part of the battle, but merely a distraction to keep the British occupied and, if possible, draw some of the troops away from where he intended his main assault.
Yeah.
The centre was always where he was going to commit his main assault. In addition, he sent troops to the other farmhouses on the right for the same reason. The fighting at Hougoumont quickly became very intense. The French aggression very soon forced the defenders out of the orchard and part of the surrounding area, but those British and German forces managed to hang on inside the farmhouse and the walled-off garden. I mean, at one point, the French succeeded in getting into the walled-off garden, the compound, but stiff resistance, hand-to-hand fighting, enabled the defenders to close the doors behind them and close the gates. The French that did make it inside were all killed.
Yeah.
Now, Wellington later acknowledged this particular action at Hougoumont was one of the most decisive parts of the whole battle. And it was only made possible because at the rear of the farmhouse there was a small lane which led back to Wellington's main force. This was named by the Allied forces as the Hollow Way. And it was vital that this was defended in order to maintain supplies and men to the besieged farmhouse. Wellington would eventually commit 21 battalions and over 12,000 men to do this.
Wow. So this small part of the battle that wasn't supposed to be ended up being pretty major.
It's nowhere near as many as Napoleon had hoped. And they were from Wellington's reserve, not the centre of his line.
Yeah.
But Napoleon wasn't wrong. After about an hour, which would be around midday, 80 French cannons opened up on the centre of Wellington's position. Now, his army was out of sight on the reverse side of the hill, and a lot of the cannon shot actually found their mark, because they fired over the crest of the hill. They didn't know what they were hitting.
Yeah.
But they fired out. And it caused significant damage to those hidden forces. The first French infantry attack on Wellington's centre came around 1 o'clock in the afternoon. But shortly afterwards, Napoleon was informed the Prussians had been spotted about 4 to 5 miles off to his right, which was only about 3 hours' march away.
How does it take 3 hours to march 4 miles?
It's a big army. You've got to
bring
it
up. Yeah,
that's true. You've got to sort them out.
I was going to say, it's not...
You could walk it, but if you've got an army of 40-odd thousand, you've got to get them in there. But they're only 3 hours away, and this was unexpected to Napoleon. He believed that Marshal Grouchy had been following them as they retreated. So he sent a message for Grouchy to come back to the battlefield and actually do what he's supposed to do and attack them, not realising that Grouchy was too far away.
Yeah.
At 1:30, the French infantry advanced towards the centre of Wellington's battlefront. They marched forward in the French block-type formation to within yards of the thin red line. The Allied forces, who were crouched in a line 4 deep, rose up and met the French with heavy, sustained musket fire. Now, Napoleon had prepared his troops for this kind of situation, and they returned fire. They continued to advance, forcing the Anglo-Dutch allies backwards. The British line was beginning to fail, and at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, Napoleon was winning the Battle of Waterloo. just yards in front of the Allied lines, the disciplined French advance was forced to break ranks. This was because, in order to reach the enemy and break their line, they had to go through some chest-high bushes, causing them to break formation. It slowed them down.
Yeah.
It was at this point that the British heavy cavalry formed up on the reverse side of the ridge, out of sight of the French, under the command of Major General Sir William Ponsonby. Now, once assembled, the cavalry crested the hill and rode down into the French infantry. This has got to go down as one of the best-timed cavalry interventions in history. Unable to defend themselves sufficiently, the French attack begins to fail, because they're suddenly confronted with sabres and horses. And
they're trying to get through a bush. They don't... Yeah.
Yeah, you can't...
They can't defend against
it. You can't. There is a defence against cavalry, but it's not what the French are doing. Their advance, the French advance, soon disintegrates, with the French retreating back to their own lines. So in the space of 20 minutes, the British heavy cavalry inflicted over 5,000 casualties on the French infantry, with a further 2,000 men being taken prisoner by the Allied infantry, who had come so close to being defeated minutes before. In fact, two of the French Eagle Standards were actually captured. At that point. Then comes the...
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices. Plus, extra ways to save. Like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. And up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices. Plus, extra ways to save. Like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. And up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Problem. Red mist now descends on the British heavy cavalry. You know what red mist is?
I've had it before. It's where you don't pay attention and you just get angry.
You get angry and you get focused on one thing and you take no notice of what's going on around you.
Yeah.
The British cavalry saw red. They saw the red mist, and it resulted in them chasing the French as they ran back to their lines. But they went too far from their own lines and ignored all the calls for them to return. Once at the bottom of the hill, the opposition cavalry, the French, now attacked. Now, the British horses and the men were exhausted. They'd just gone through a battle and then just raced down a hill.
Yeah.
This resulted in a devastating defeat for the British. The casualties included their commander, Major Sir William Ponsonby, and by the end of the day, the heavy cavalry had sustained a 49% casualty rate. Not injured, killed. 49%.
Wow.
So despite the heavy cavalry's charge, Napoleon was still winning the Battle of Waterloo.
Yeah, they just halted him for a minute, basically.
The battle at Hougoumont Farm continued, but not as Napoleon had planned. The defenders were putting up such a fierce resistance that he was forced to commit more and more French troops to the fight. If only he could capture this farm, he'd be able to move his cannons much closer to the British infantry. And in this era, nothing was more devastating to infantry than cannon fire.
Yeah.
Around 4 p.m, the infantry that had come so close to defeating Wellington's centre 2.5 hours before readied for another try. This time they were going to be assisted by the French cavalry under Marshal Ney. The plan was for the infantry to attack Wellington's now weakened centre while the French cavalry attacked the left. This would have won the battle for Napoleon, as there was no longer any Allied heavy cavalry to stop them. But it was during the preparation for this attack that the Prussians began to arrive on the battlefield in greater numbers. They swept past the left flank of Wellington's army and into the right-hand side of the French, capturing the village of Place Noire.
Yeah.
Now, that's on Napoleon's right. This forced Napoleon to use troops with most of his reserve troops
to recapture
it and basically hold it. So he's now sent his reserves in to hold this village. And he succeeded. You know, Wellington succeeded in doing that. They recaptured the village.
Napoleon
recaptured the village. It's not certain that Marshal Ney knew that the infantry he was to support had been actually redeployed.
Mm.
Okay, but what is known is he believed he saw the British line retreating back from Hougoumont, leaving the defenders to fend for themselves. This wasn't actually the case. They were actually evacuating the wounded from the farmhouse. And he did know that most of the infantry units were already engaged. So he didn't know the ones that he was supposed to support were there, but he knew that the rest of the infantry was already engaged. So Ney decides to personally lead a massed French cavalry charge to run down the withdrawing forces and break Wellington's line at the centre.
Mm-hmm.
This would effectively win the battle for the French. So that's what he did, without authorization from Napoleon. But the British weren't retreating. Wellington had seen the French cavalry begin to form up, and before they could advance, he ordered the infantry on the reverse side of the hill to form squares. This is the best defence against a cavalry attack. It's not a new tactic. It'd been around since Roman times, and it continued well into the mid-20th century. In fact, the last use of a square against cavalry was in 1936 at the Battle of Shire during the Second Italian-Ethiopia War. Mm. And on a side note, your American listeners would know it is also a defence used by the pioneers against the Native Americans in the March West. You know, the putting the wagons in a circle.
Yeah.
It's the same theory.
Yeah, because you can see 360 degrees around and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, in Wellington's case, he formed his infantry into several hollow squares. Now, a square of this type would require around 500 soldiers. The officers with a reserve force would be positioned in the centre. These reserves would be utilised to fill gaps that might appear in the outer sides of the square. The squares would be very tightly packed, shoulder to shoulder. And in this particular case, the squares were only 60 feet on each side. Now, the squares were formed in a checkerboard formation. Now, this minimised the risk of soldiers from one square shooting into another.
Mm-hmm.
And a tight checkerboard with minimal gaps between the corners of adjacent squares was actually extremely effective, and it minimised the cavalry's freedom of movement.
Yeah.
Each side of the square had four ranks, all with bayonets fixed on their single-shot muskets. First rank would be kneeling with muskets and bayonets pointing at an angle of 45 degrees. The second and or third ranks would be stood with the bayonet fixed, muskets to the shoulder, taking aim, ready for the order to open fire. They would fire in rank order. The role of the third rank depended on the circumstances. They could either be used as loaders or shooters. The fourth rank would always be reloading the muskets for the ranks in front. The infantry waited until the advancing cavalry was at a range of about 30 metres. And then the commanders of each square gave the order to open fire. Now, this had the effect of dropping the enemy soldiers and horses at a distance sufficient to cause problems for the cavalry behind and slowing the advance, and allowed the square's front ranks to change muskets for the loaded ones.
Hmm.
This tactic required all those in the square to be well disciplined, because an unorganized single shot of the rank would be ineffective and cause problems for those behind helping to reload. So this would give the advancing cavalry a chance to get much closer, and by you getting that close, they could use their pistols.
Yeah, and that would cause...
If they managed to get even closer, they could use their lances. If the squares fired too late, the stricken cavalry would fall into the squares, which would create openings. And then the uninjured cavalry can enter the square and break it up from inside.
Yeah, once a horse was in there...
Squares were immensely effective against cavalry, providing the infantry held its nerve. Horses, like any other animal, will not put themselves in danger, and they won't intentionally run into sharp points. Horses as a species tend to fear dense areas due to the ability of predators to hide in them. So despite all the urging of the riders, the horses did their best to remain out of harm's way. This put them in the precise position the squares needed to take them out.
Yeah, that's why it's effective.
And Ney believed he was running down the retreating army, so didn't require artillery or infantry support. Perhaps if he had, the result would be different. Ney only realised this situation once the French cavalry got to the top of the hill, and by then it's too late to modify his orders. The cavalry charged down the reverse side of the hill directly into the area occupied by Wellington's squares. This is the iconic scene of the Battle of Waterloo.
Yeah, it is.
Cavalry versus squares.
Yeah.
The French cavalry made numerous attempts to break the squares, but were unable to have any impact. In fact, throughout history, there have only been very, very few occasions when cavalry have succeeded in breaking squares. True to form, the infantry's nerve held, and the horses, along with their riders, sustained a considerable number of casualties from both musket fire, and there was artillery there, you know, off to the sides. So how bad was this part of the battle? It was devastating for the French. Without infantry or cannon support, the French cavalry were just sitting ducks. They were target practice for the infantry. Single example I'll give you would be François-Antoine Fauvet. He was just one of the French heavy cavalry who rode towards the Allied squares on that day. He was 23 years old, he was 5'8" tall, and he was a butter maker before joining Napoleon. During one of the many charges made on the squares, he was hit by a 9-pound, which is a 4-inch cannonball. The round went through his armoured chest plate, through him and out the back of his armour, killing him instantly. We know this because his breastplate was recovered after the battle and is now on display at the Musée de l'Armée in Paris. And he was just one of the riders killed on that day. And I tell you what, when this goes out, I will put a picture of his armour on your Facebook page.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
I'm going to have a look now, see if I can find it.
What you need to do is look for François Fauvet.
Oh, I've got it. Straight away.
Straight away.
That one.
That's it.
That's mental. Do you know what's weird about that? And I know you guys are going to see it. But you know when you talk about rifles and you talk about the I use a 303 for an example, because this is what I used to shoot, and you was always told that the round would enter and it would leave a hole in the chest about the size of your thumb, and the hole out the back would be the size of your fist, so it would go in, shatter and explode out the back. That's the same size the whole way through, which means it's not pierced anything, it's literally pushed everything through.
Yeah.
So, like, whereas with a rifle, it'll enter you, and then it'll pierce through any skin, pierce through your heart or whatever.
And the shockwave takes out everything around it.
Yeah.
But there's no shockwave with the cannonball.
No, it's literally it's hit just, and
it,
take
yeah.
and taken probably all the organs out with it.
Mm.
That's mental.
It's a good picture, though, isn't it?
It is a good picture.
I will put it up on your Facebook page for those people who don't have, who can't be bothered to look it up.
Yeah, well, there will be some.
There will be some, yeah.
That's a cool picture.
Yeah. So, around 6 p.m., the French captured the farmhouse at La Haye Sainte.
The one in the centre.
Directly in the centre of the battlefield. Directly in front of the centre of the British line. Immediately, Napoleon's got his cannons up.
Yeah.
He's shoved his cannons into that position. From that position, the French can fire directly into the British squares at close range.
Yeah.
You can't miss. The inevitable major casualties quickly mounted, and it became obvious to the British if they didn't retreat, they'd be wiped out.
Yeah.
The battle would be lost. Napoleon was still winning the Battle of Waterloo.
Yeah. Yeah, he is. There's no... He's got the upper hand.
Yeah. He's still on course to win. I mean, he wasn't having it his own way. The Prussians were now arriving in force on his right side, and he was running out of men, and he'd been forced to put all his reserve into the new front, which is not what he wanted. He would have preferred to send them against Wellington. So Napoleon needed a victory fast.
Yeah.
Now. He made the final throw of the dice. He sent the ultimate reserve, the Immortals.
The French Guard.
The
Old Guard.
Yeah, the Old Guard. The best trained, the best equipped, the most frightening, impressive soldiers in the world at the time.
Yeah. They look similar to the guards that stand outside of Buckingham Palace, but with a stupid blue coat instead of a red one.
Mm-hmm. 9 infantry battalions totaling 3,000 men in 3 waves, and he sent them towards Wellington's line, the centre of Wellington's line. These are the most impressive, well-equipped, most experienced elite soldiers of the time. Now, these troops
and the British knew that as well. This is like the other thing you've got to remember. They've dealt with the cavalry. They've dealt with this. They've dealt with that. They've essentially fought off everything that Napoleon's thrown at them. And now it's like, oh shit, now it's getting real. Because now you've got basically the guys who've never lost a battle, more or less.
They had never lost a battle.
Had they not?
No.
Yeah.
The Imperial Guard had never lost a battle.
Yeah. So it's a bit of a... I mean...
And you can't miss them. They've got these big, tall fur hats.
Yeah. Making like the bearskins, aren't they?
Making them 8, 9, 10 feet tall.
Yeah.
You can see them coming.
Yeah. It's intimidating.
It's massively intimidating. It's what it's designed to do. These troops advanced on the British positions... Now, Wellington knew they were coming even before they formed up, because about half an hour before, a French deserter had actually informed Napoleon what informed Wellington what Napoleon was actually planning. Mm. And given that Marshal Blücher had now arrived in force on Napoleon's right, Wellington was able to move his own left flank into the centre to meet this new threat.
Yeah.
The Imperial Guard were dispatched and they marched steadily to the top of the rise and the centre of the British line. For fear of cavalry attack, they actually advanced forward in squares, which was unusual for the French. But from the British point of view, they still gave the impression of advancing in ranks.
Yeah.
But this accounts for historical differences in reports from either side. Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. The first wave made their way forward. British batteries, the cannons opened up, firing canister and double canister from the front and from one side, the French left, while skirmishers and sharpshooters aimed at the French officers and generals. Weapons of the day all used black powder, which created vast amounts of smoke when fired, and it had the effect of completely obscuring the battlefield straight after the first volley was fired. In fact, the visibility was reduced to only a few yards. But with the firing of the British guns, the guards wavered. They faltered. And then they continued past the farmhouse of La Haye Sainte. The Prussians now opened up on the advancing French from their right. And the French were now entering a box of cannon and musket fire, namely from the front and both sides. They continued to advance. They reached the British line. They captured a number of British cannons, their gunners just retreating and leaving the guns behind, and they turned the guns on the British.
Wow.
The second wave now caught up with the first. Both marched on towards the British infantry. They maintained formation, marching steadily now in line formation, heading for General Sir Halkett's infantry battalion. Halkett's battalion now changed formation from square to four deep lines, but the French cannons, along with the captured British ones, took a massive toll. The British panicked, turned, and ran in total disorder down the reverse side of the hill. Had the Imperial Guard succeeded in breaking Wellington's line? They thought so. Upon reaching the crest of the hill, there was no sign of the British. Only General Chassé's depleted Netherlands division could be seen, and they were falling back. All appeared to be going well for the French. In fact, a wounded French general, General Friant, actually left the engagement at this point to return back to the French lines and tell the Emperor that all was going well and they were winning. Realising that he was the last line of defence, General Chasse ordered his troops to fix bayonets, changed their formation from squares to four ranks, and prepare to engage the best in the world. He had at his disposal a battery of horse artillery, which he directed to his right, which was the French left. The Imperial French Guard marched out of the smoke in full line order. Instantly, Frederick Cramer de Buchan's horse battery opened fire on the front ranks of the French from the side, firing canister and double canister. Their shots smashed through the blue-coated French, causing huge casualties. The reverse side of the hill wasn't as empty as the French believed. Laying down in the grass to avoid cannon fire were two battalions of British foot guards under the command of General Peregrine Maitland. On the shout of "Up, guards!" they rose up and fired a devastating volley of musket fire into the advancing French. This was followed by a bayonet charge. Faced with this previously unseen threat, the Imperial Guard stumbled, held, and then the third wave of guards arrived. More volleys of fire came from the Allies. Still, the Imperial Guard advanced for a third time. It took more fire from the British before the French faltered, turned around, broke, and ran back to the French lines. General Chasse's division, along with the British Guards, broke rank and chased them back down the slope with a bayonet charged, followed 10 minutes later by the remainder of Wellington's army. Seeing the Immortals break was such a shock for the French. Never before had the Imperial Guard failed. Never had they been beaten in battle. The effect on Nelson's whole army was instant. Once word got round that the Guard had retreated, the remainder of his troops turned and left the battlefield.
Yeah. I'm not surprised.
After the battle, the foot guards, believing that they had faced the grenadiers in the French Imperial Guard, changed their name out of respect to the Grenadier Guards.
That's what Grandad was in.
It is. And they still wear the tall bearskin headdress for the same reason, which is what you said earlier.
Huh?
The reason the British wear the British guards at the palace and the ceremonial dress is out of respect to the French Imperial Guard. It's a French hat.
Wow, I never knew that. I can't believe I never knew that. That's amazing. But they all wear it, though. The Grenadiers.
All the Guards.
Yeah, the Scots, the Welsh, the Irish. Who's the other one? The Coldstream.
The Coldstream, yeah.
Coldstream Guards. That's the start of the show, is the Grenadier Guards.
There you go.
Yeah. Might have to change it now. I know it's French.
I don't know. Less than an hour after he'd sent the Imperial Guard in, Napoleon knew the battle had been lost. He left the battle with a squadron of light cavalry for protection. He did later try to escape to America. But on the 15th of July, he surrendered to a British warship that was blockading the harbour, in which the ship to America was actually waiting.
So he was literally about to go.
Yeah. This was the first step in his exile to St. Helena, where he actually ended his days.
At least he wasn't killed.
Yeah. At the end of the battle, the area was littered with thousands of wounded and dead men, along with thousands of horses. In fact, there were over 50,000 men alone.
Wow.
On that battlefield. Many were wounded, and they were just left laying on the ground to die. In fact, many human remains were still on the battlefield a year later, despite scavengers arriving within hours.
Yeah, they always did, though, after battles then.
There were instances of these people taking things from the dead. This included removing teeth from the corpses for denture replacements in Britain.
Wow.
In fact, Waterloo teeth, as they were known, were in great demand at the time because they'd come from young, healthy men.
Hmm.
So, eventually, the battlefield was cleared of the dead, but here lies a mystery. Only two skeletons have ever been recovered from the battlefield. Of the rest, there is no trace.
How's that possible?
Now, possible reason for the absence of human remains in any quantity is that European battlefields were often scoured for bones to make bone meal, which was much in demand as a fertilizer before the discovery of superphosphates in the 1840s. And it is likely that in the aftermath of the conflict, local farmers dug up the corpses of horses and men and sold them to the Waterloo sugar factory. There, the ground down bones were fired in kilns to make bone char, which was then used to filter sugar syrup as part of the production process.
So everyone was eating human remains when they was having their sugar.
Yeah.
That's a bit gross.
But there you go. That's that was my phone going off.
Oh, I didn't hear it. I don't know if anyone else heard it.
Well, if you did hear it, unfortunately, that was my phone going off. So,
professional.
Now, just a little tiny bit. Napoleon had fought over 80 battles.
Yeah.
He'd only lost 10.
And I bet the majority of them were right at the start.
Wellington had only fought 30 battles. But Wellington had never been defeated.
Mm.
Neither had ever met on the battlefield before, but they knew each other. They knew the tactics, they knew what they went on. So there you go. That was a brief description of the battle that ended Napoleon's rule, and one of the most influential ones in history. Although the British claim it as their victory, they only made up a third of the winning side.
Yeah.
And they so very nearly lost it.
I think with the British, I mean, obviously
we claim a lot of things.
Yeah, we claim it. But I think when you think about the battle and you look at who was involved, the Prussians don't exist anymore. There is no Prussian Empire anymore. The Austrian history is mainly sort of the Second World War and their escapades into Turkey and things like that. I mean, Vienna and the battles. Mm. So their history isn't really surrounded by the French. The Dutch possibly would talk about Waterloo, but I don't see many countries really talking about it. The British have, you know, it's one, we beat the French, which is the old enemy, and we end it, are the main man in charge was British.
Yeah.
Well, one of the two, because Blücher was probably the just as important, but obviously he's Prussian. Well, Prussia doesn't exist
if
now.
If Blücher hadn't turned up,
We'd have lost. Yeah.
There's no doubt about that. If Ney's forces hadn't have been batted from one side to the other early on, the day before,
yeah,
we would have lost.
Yeah. But on the flip side, we could have, if our cavalry had been more disciplined and not charged down the hill, we might have won it earlier.
Could have
done. Oh, there goes the dog.
Could have done.
Don't worry about that. There we go. We have a dog. So, yeah. I mean, I find that the two really interesting things I find with Wellington is, I will do an episode on Arthur Wellesley, who is the Duke of Wellington, because he's a fascinating character, and he came from nothing. I mean, absolutely nothing. As in the days where to become a soldier in the army, you could be anybody, but to become an officer in the army, you had to buy in.
You had to be a somebody.
Yeah. And he came from a nothing household. He got as far up as he could without the ability of buying himself a leadership. And he built from there to become, you know, one of the greatest British leaders of all time. So,
he was, wasn't he?
He was asked after the battle, and there's a few quotes from him that he's got some really good quotes, but the two that always stay with me is he was asked about Napoleon. And he said, Napoleon's presence on a battlefield is the same as 40,000 men.
Yeah.
You know, the amount of respect he had for Napoleon was unbelievable. He was also asked, towards the end of his career, who was the greatest general that you've ever faced? And he said, before I faced, when I faced, and after I faced, it will always be Napoleon. Napoleon was the best general that ever lived.
Well, you'd put him in. I'd put him in the same category as Julius Caesar, Genghis Khan.
Yeah.
Saladin.
Yeah.
You know he was. You know.
He was without a doubt. I mean, and in reality, when you look at it, I know the Battle of Waterloo is a massive thing for the British, and it ended the Napoleonic Wars, but it was luck.
It was pure luck.
It was luck. We didn't beat the French. We lucked to beat the French. It was... excuse me, I've got a really bad cough. It was pure luck. And it's gone down in history because obviously what it... The effects, the aftermath of the battle and what it meant to peace in Europe and obviously the end of the Hundred Years' War, the end of the... I mean, you go back, you had the 30 Years' War, you had the Hundred Years' War, the Napoleonic Wars. These were all British versus the French. So to finally put a stop to that, and since then there hasn't been...
Going on even longer, you got...
You got 1066, if you want to go real far back.
Yep, you've got 1066, but you've also got Joan of Arc.
Mm.
You know, and...
Yeah, I mean, it's the
British and the French have been antagonizing each other for centuries.
Yeah, and you know, even like I said, you're going back 1,000 years for the Norman invasion of England, but it's mental to think that that battle essentially put an end to all of that because there's never been a British and French battle since then.
No, it hasn't.
You know, in fact, since then we've been allies. You know, we were allies in the First World War, allies in the Second World War, even to now. You know, the only time that we refused to go and help them was Vietnam, but the Americans got their back for that. So, it was very much. But I mean, they never had our back in the Falklands, to be fair. So it was.
You sort of think. I mean, I when I did the research for this, didn't realize how close we came to losing
the
Battle of Waterloo. Not just once.
Yeah.
We came close several times.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that we managed to get squares, the fact that the French army didn't arrive when it should have done, and the Prussians have arrived, but the Prussians have arrived and Napoleon is still very, very close to winning.
Yeah. It was outnumbered at that point.
If there'd have been a fourth wave of Imperial Guard.
Yeah. That could have been it.
That'd have been it.
Yeah. I mean, it's mental.
It is so, so close.
And you don't think about it because we're not really... I mean, we're taught about the victory. We're taught about... I mean, I remember in school in history, you're taught about Trafalgar. You're taught about Waterloo. But you're only taught, we had a battle. It was in Waterloo. We won. This was the main point. This is who we beat. And that's it.
Yeah.
You're not given...
About 15 minutes. Already.
Yeah, you're not taught... Well, actually, we were pretty lucky to win...
We were.
Yeah, we were. So
and you've got to think that the Imperial Guard, just to say the Imperial Guard, there were only 3,000 of them in three waves.
Yeah.
That's 1,000 a wave. Yeah. And they came so close.
I mean, that's how good they were, though.
And if you had another 1,000 Imperial Guard, they'd have won that.
Mm. When they were facing, what, 30,000 British?
If Ney, instead of attacking the squares on his own, had brought in cavalry and infantry. Not cavalry and infantry, artillery and infantry.
Yeah.
End of squares.
Yeah.
Because a square cannot take...
Artillery. It's too easy.
It's too easy. You're a static target.
Yeah.
So, all of that, if Ney had have waited just that little bit longer for that central farmhouse to fall...
Yeah.
The squares would have gone. He'd have ridden them. He'd have ridden down the bridge. There, so many little tiny things that actually we were lucky—not just once, but several times.
Yeah, I find that really interesting because, like I said, I've wanted to do the Battle of Waterloo. I mean, there are bits there that I didn't even know, and I do know this story quite well. So I find it fascinating that there's still. I mean, I always find it amazing that. I can know a subject as much as I think I know it, and you still manage to find parts that I don't know. But I mean, it's probably one of the biggest parts of British history, and it's shocking to think how close we were to not winning it. And yeah, I think it's fascinating. Really, really enjoyed that episode, and I've wanted to do it for such a long time. I will get one out. On Arthur Wellesley,
you'll do one eventually.
Yeah, I'll do one when I get time. But yeah, we'll do one on Arthur Wellesley, the Duke of Wellington, because his military career is fascinating. And I did do one on Nelson before we did Trafalgar, but I'm not going to make you guys wait for that because God knows when I'm going to find time. I'll try and get it out as soon as possible.
It's taken a bit of time for us to actually get to this one.
It has, yeah. But Yeah, fascinating episode, fantastic again, and thank you for coming on the show again. So, thanks for listening, guys, and we'll see you next time.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.